And now for reading and writing and radio.
It is mid-spring. Daddy returns from an out-of-state trip to find the fields parched. The seed is in, but there has been no rain to bring it up. The hay fields are brown. If there is not rain quickly, all the farmers will suffer heavy losses. Daddy shakes his fist at the sky. "What's the matter up there?" he yells. "Let's have some rain down here. Don't you know how to run your own business?" The skies blacken, and the wind rises. Within a half hour, it begins to rain. That afternoon, 3 to 4 inches pour down in the space of a few hours. The deluge washes out a lot of the seed. Daddy is inclined to blame the catastrophe on his neighbor Lang, who was plowing on Sunday. But another neighbor, Howard Lentell, thinks differently. "Next time, Ron," he says, "shake only 2 fingers.
The author of that washout from the Round Barn was Jackie Jackson. But you too can write up a storm. WSSR Radio at Sangamon State University presents Reading and Writing and Radio, a program about creative writing. Your host is Jacqueline Jackson, children's author and professor of literature at Sangamon State University.
Last year, one of the programs you all liked best was The Round Barn, stories from the book I'm writing about the farm I grew up on, and that my father grew up on, too, before me. I'm still working on the book, and I'm back today with more stories from The Round Barn. Let's start with The One-Armed Milkman. I'm Marcy, and in case you don't know, our next sound effect is going to be authentic milk bottles rattling in an authentic milk bottle carrier. It is a sunny morning in early summer. Marcy and Thad are playing Find the Milkman. It is a game they have played all their lives. It goes like this. A milkman is out on his route, and Daddy has to get a hold of him for some reason, such as to give him additional milk for a customer, or to tell him there's one he's missed. Daddy drives to the area where the milkman is delivering. Any children in the car take opposite windows. "Keep your eyes peeled," says Daddy, and he cruises the streets, going slowly through intersections while everybody peers up and down them, looking for the familiar yellow vehicle. Finally, someone spots it, yells out, Daddy jams on the brakes, reverses the car, heads for the truck, and the game is over. Sometimes the game takes quite a while, for a truck has so many streets it can be on and houses it can dodge behind that it can stay hidden for a surprising stretch. And all this without the milkman doing it deliberately. He does not realize he is the object of hide-and-seek. He reacts as though Daddy's running into him on his rounds is a pleasant coincidence. Today, however, Daddy is perplexed. "Vanished," he keeps saying. "He's evaporated off the face of the earth." He is Charlie, the one-armed milkman. Along around 8 o'clock, calls began coming in from customers on his route that the milkman had missed them or hadn't arrived yet. After 4 or 5 calls, Daddy had slung a case of milk in the truck, taken Thad and Marcy, and headed for town to play Find the Milkman. Here was the situation. Using a last month's route book as a guide, Daddy had traced Charlie's route. Charlie had delivered the start of it. Then, at a corner, and between one page and the next of the route book, he had disappeared. Everyone before had had milk. Those after were the ones telephoning. Daddy is mystified. At first, he'd figured Charlie's truck had broken down, but why then hadn't he called for Irv or Ed, the farm mechanics, to come to town and fix it? And more to the point, where is the broken-down truck? It should be on this very corner. Daddy goes into a customer's house and calls the police. He returns to the car, shaking his head. There have been no accidents reported involving a milk truck, but they will alert all their patrolmen to be on the lookout for a one-armed milkman. The hospital, too, says they have not recently admitted a milkman with one arm, but will call if they do. "Keep your eyes peeled," Daddy says to Thad and Marcy, and they all go back to playing Find the Milkman around the blocks of Charlie's Route. After 10 more minutes, Daddy gives up. He speeds back to the dairy, collars Roscoe Oker, the relief driver who is working in the milk house that day, and together they load up the farm truck with milk for Charlie's customers. Thad and Marcy perch on the loading platform and drink chocolate milk. "You kids might as well stay home," says Daddy, but the two have no intention of abandoning the search now. They are eager to return to the scene. They climb into the back of the truck with the milk and bounce and rattle to town. At the disappearance corner, everyone becomes a team. Roscoe drives and calls out orders from the route book. Up behind, Daddy loads carriers and hands them down to Marcy or Thad. On the street, Marcy and Thad lug the milk orders up to people's doors as hastily as the weight of the load will permit. Daddy laughs and says, "Never has a milk route been delivered so fast." At every corner, Marcy still peels her eyes for Charlie's missing truck. For 45 minutes, they deliver. Then Roscoe rounds another corner, and they are radiator to radiator with a Dogan milk truck. The one-armed milkman is just returning to it, his wire carrier swinging jauntily from his single hand. "Charlie!" shouts Daddy with relief and exasperation. "Oh, hello," smiles Charlie, as if he had not been the concern of customers, management, police, and hospitals for the past several hours, and as if meeting Daddy and Roscoe, Marcy and Thad running his route is a usual occurrence. "Whatever happened to you? Where have you been? We've searched everywhere," Daddy expostulates. "Your customers have been calling since 8 o'clock. Charlie looks surprised. He sets down his carrier, scratches his chin, gazes at the sky. Then he grins sheepishly. "Well, today, partway along, I suddenly realized how bored I was delivering my route the same old way every day," says Charlie. "So I just drove to the last house and started going backwards. That's all." Daddy shakes his head wearily. "Mon Dieu," he exclaims. "Tell me the next time you get bored, and I'll give you variety." But Marcy nods. She understands perfectly how Charlie feels. So does Thad. "And just think," Thad says, as they ride among the milk cases with Charlie following them in his truck out Collie Road, "just think how many other people were saved from a boring morning by our one-armed milkman." This next is called The Roman Catholic Cow. Father O'Reilly is the Roman Catholic priest at St. Thomas's Church near downtown Beloit. One year he calls up Daddy. "Ron," he says, "every year we have a big bazaar down here, a big carnival in our church basement to raise money. It lasts for 3 days, from 10 in the morning till 10 at night, and a couple thousand people come. This year we're selling space to local merchants to set up their displays and advertise their wares. Can I reserve you a space?" "Father," responds Daddy, "the only way I can use your space is if I bring you a cow." Father O'Reilly doesn't even hesitate. "Ah, Ron, that's a splendid idea," he says, "but it'll cost you 2 spaces. Tell you what, I'll give you a discount on the second one." Daddy argues. He tells Father O'Reilly the dimensions of a stanchion. He says he'll bring down his smallest cow, who he is sure can be fitted into 1 space unless she is allotted only a tabletop. He points out that he is running a real risk, exposing a naive Methodist cow who has never left home to the wiles of Babylon. Father O'Reilly laughs and signs Daddy up for 1 space. Fair time arrives, and Daddy and a hired man transport a gentle Guernsey cow down to the church. She is sleek and handsome and named T-12, but Daddy paints a sign to go on her pen calling her Bathsheba. They fix her up with lots of sawdust bedding and a salt block and hay and water and a sack of grain from which she will get her daily scoops. Daddy hires a boy to stay near her and shovel up her cow pies when she makes them, and carry away the wet sawdust when she pees. The boy also sells half pints of Dogan's chocolate milk to the fairgoers. All during the carnival, Bathsheba looks out at the crowd with gentle brown eyes. Sometimes she eats hay. Sometimes she lies down and chews her cud. Every morning early, a barn hand drives downtown to milk her, and Father O'Reilly unlocks the church basement and lets him in. Bathsheba moos a quiet welcome from among the still displays. Afternoons, Daddy does the milkings. He wears a white cap and apron and black boots and makes the milk zing into the pail as the crowds press round the pen. He squirts milk into children's mouths with fine accuracy. After Bathsheba is finished, Marcy and Thad pour her warm milk into paper cups. Whoever wishes to can have a drink. When they are not busy at the pen, Marcy and Thad wander among the many booths and exhibits and eat donuts and cotton candy. They feel strange to be in a Roman Catholic church, even if it is the basement. It does not seem very different from the Methodist church basement, although Thad points out a calendar where Jesus' heart is outside his body with rays coming out from it. The final day, Daddy rounds up a lot of children under 12 to enter a milking contest. Most have never milked. They sit awkwardly on the three-legged stool and hold the tits as if they are hot. Daddy instructs them. But one girl needs no instruction. She settles onto the stool, presses her head into Bathsheba's belly, and milks like a pro. Daddy recognizes her. She is the daughter of the one Roman Catholic family in Turtle Township. He gives her a prize of a book of milk tickets that she can exchange for chocolate milk. Throughout the carnival, Bathsheba is the center of attraction. She is a model guest, quiet and well-behaved. The Beloit Daily News comes and takes her picture during the milking contest, and it makes the front page. The headline is, "Holy Cow!" Daddy and Father O'Reilly and everybody are well pleased. Bathsheba is invited back for next year. In only one way does she cause any problem. Though the carnival is in progress, upstairs in the church the services continue on schedule. Father O'Reilly celebrates daily masses. These are quiet affairs, and Bathsheba is not aware of them, nor are the worshippers aware of a cow's presence below. But on the last day of the carnival there is a wedding. The organ booms out with the wedding march. Bathsheba stretches her neck, raises her voice, and bellows along. When the organ plays Ave Maria, Bathsheba's voice is louder than the soloist's. And when the organ starts the recessional, Bathsheba fairly trumpets down the house. It is not a wedding that anyone will soon forget. Back home, Bathsheba settles into the round barn routine as if she'd never been away. Fame and bright lights have not turned her head. She is the same sweet and unspoiled bovine that she was before she became a celebrity. When Daddy shows any visitors through the round barn, he points her out. "All of our cows are Methodist," he says, "except for that one apostate. That is Bathsheba, our Roman Catholic cow." This one is about my father when he was 8 years old, and this would have been in 1910. Ronald is in third grade. His teacher, Helen Gillette, rooms at the farm. She takes her meals with Grandpa and Grandma, Ronald and Trevor, and all the hired men at the big table in the dining room. Ronald thinks the sun rises and sets in Miss Gillette. He goes across the field with her early in the morning, carrying both lunch buckets. He helps her open the schoolhouse, get the fire going, carry in wood, fill the water bucket. After school, he washes the blackboard and claps the erasers on the outside of the school building so vigorously that the clouds of chalk dust make him sneeze. He helps sweep out and tidy up. Then he walks back across the field with her, carrying both lunch buckets, now empty. Trevor, in first grade, likes Miss Gillette too, but he can't be bothered coming early and staying late. Miss Gillette is fond of both boys, but she is concerned about Ronald. As soon as Ronald gets home from school, he curls up with a book. He reads until supper time. After supper, he settles down again and reads till bedtime. Miss Gillette is pleased that Ronald likes reading so much, but she is concerned that he does not get enough exercise, does not play outdoors. All he does is read. She makes a bargain with him. She will read to him every evening after supper for an hour if he will play outdoors after school until supper time. Ronald agrees. He loves reading, but even more he loves being read to, especially if the reader is Miss Gillette. The year progresses. Every afternoon after school, Ronald plays outdoors with Trevor. They have races in the field across from the house, starting with the big tree and each following the fence in the opposite direction, passing each other on the far side of the field, and then running on around and back to the big tree. Though Ronald is older, Trevor usually wins. When Ronald gets a stitch in his side, he has to stop quickly and spit underneath a stone. That is a sure cure. They gather horse apples from the horse barn and keep them in special spots. Ronald's cache is in an unused horse manger. When the cold weather comes, the horse apples freeze solid and they have horse apple fights. They don't have to wait for snowballs. Ronald usually is the victor in a horse apple fight. They find an old umbrella in the farm dump and make bows and arrows to play Indian. The long spokes form the bows. They tie bowsprings to arch them. The short spokes are the arrows. They hold the arrows to the grindstone and pump the treadle. The grindstone whirls. Sparks fly from the spoke. They grind until the spoke becomes needle sharp. Trevor shoots an arrow and hits Ronald in the eye. They rush him to the hospital. The arrow pierced the white part. He will not lose his sight, but he wears a patch for a month. Grandma confiscates the bows and arrows. And every night Miss Gillette reads aloud St. Nicholas and Dickens and the Little Shepherd of Kingdom Come. Trevor and Ronald with his patch on curl up on either side of her. Grandma listens and knits. Sometimes Grandma plays a game of chess with Grandpa during the reading, for though he is glad it is going on, he cannot hear it. On some nights, however, Miss Gillette does not read. She has a beau whose name is Red Beaumeister. He has fiery red hair. He comes out to the farm and carries Miss Gillette away in his buggy. Ronald watches them go and feels twinges of jealousy. He wishes he were old enough to be Miss Gillette's beau. Spring comes. Ronald pokes a bar of metal from the dump through a barbed wire fence. He turns it over and over, winding up two strands of barbed wire till they are taut as a spring and will turn no farther. Then he lets go. The spring unwinds in a flash, spinning the bar of metal faster than the vanes on a windmill in a high gale. At the end, the bar spins right out of the fence and strikes Trevor on the chin. They rush Trevor to the hospital. He has to have 7 stitches. Ronald learns that Miss Gillette is going to marry Red Beaumeister. The wedding is going to be on the lawn of the big house as soon as school is out. The spireus bushes and Grandma's roses will be the background. Grandpa will be the minister. Grandma will bake the cake and handle the reception. Everyone is invited, Ronald and Trevor, the hired men, the school children and their families, people from town. It will be a gala event. Although Ronald is sorry he cannot marry Miss Gillette, he accepts the fate that has made such a difference in their ages and pitches vigorously into the wedding preparations. He helps Grandma with the kitchen work, keeping the wood box full for the baking, peeling chicken off the bones of boiled hens for the chicken salad. He helps the hired men groom the lawn. He helps Miss Gillette pick flowers to put around the house. He hangs over his father's shoulder while Grandpa refreshes himself on the wedding service. On the morning of the great day, he helps carry all the chairs from the house to the front yard and arrange them in rows. Then he helps the hired men build trestles of planks laid across milk cases for the overflow guests. When there is nothing more for him to do, he goes and takes a bath. He washes his hair. He gets dressed in his Sunday suit, a white shirt and a tie, his long black stockings and his best shoes. He goes to the kitchen. Grandma exclaims when she sees him, "My goodness, Ronald, it's an hour and a half till the wedding. Don't get dirty now." Ronald wanders around, keeping clean. Everybody else is still busy. He takes a book he has just begun, A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, and goes up to his room. He settles on his bed and begins to read. He reads how the Yankee is transported back to King Arthur's time. He reads how he saves himself from death at the stake by predicting the exact time of an eclipse of the sun. He reads how it feels to joust in a ludicrously hot and heavy suit of armor, and worse yet, have a fly invade your helmet. He reads and reads, lost in the magic of Camelot. He finally reaches the last line, finishes it, and takes a moment to return to reality. The sun slants through his window. Suddenly he remembers the wedding. He sits up, transfixed. Things are strangely silent. He leaps off his bed, flings open the door, races downstairs through the empty house out onto the lawn. He stops dead. Some hired men are carrying the trestles away. Out on the road, Trevor is throwing a stick for old Bob to chase. There is no sign of Grandma or Grandpa, the bride or the groom. Ronald stands stricken. The wedding is over. He has read straight through it. He crawls into the middle of the lilac bush where no one can see him and cries. And for our last story, it is 1913. It is spring. Grandpa has not been working outside at the planting or manure spreading or in the barn. All afternoon he has been laboring at his desk in the bedroom. It is a large roll-top desk. Ronald and Trevor are once in a while allowed to roll up the top so that it is magically swallowed inside the desk, and then they get to pull it down again. The desk has many cubby holes along its back, which Ronald and Trevor are not allowed to explore. Each cubby hole has different papers and receipts in it. The drawers at the side hold large cloth-bound ledgers held together with fat steel pins. All afternoon, nobody has disturbed Grandpa at his desk. Supper time comes. Grandma and Ronald and Trevor and the hired men are waiting. Grandpa is a few minutes late. Grandma goes and calls him again. Grandpa comes into the dining room holding an envelope. His face is severe. He puts the envelope beside his plate and sits down at the head of the table. Ronald feels uneasy. The hired men stir. They seem to feel uneasy, too. All eyes are on the envelope. Grandpa bows his head. All the rest bow their heads, too, except for Ronald. He cranes his neck over to see the address on the envelope, but Grandpa has placed it face down. Everyone waits for one of Grandpa's usual weekday blessings, the one that starts, "Bless the Lord, O my soul," or the one that starts, "Praise the Lord, all ye nations, praise him, all ye peoples." But Grandpa pauses a long time, then clears his throat and says something new. "Render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, and unto God that which is God's. Amen." Everyone looks up, startled. Grandpa picks up the envelope. No one moves to pass the platters of food. "Our government has just instituted an income tax," Grandpa says grimly. Everyone nods. The income tax has been a topic of discussion before, at the table, and Ronald and Trevor have talked about it in school. "I have spent the day computing my income tax," Grandpa continues. "I completed it just before supper, and I have written the check and placed it in this envelope." He holds up the envelope and steadies it, then reads aloud the address. He raises the flap and plucks out a large, tan farm check. He surveys the check even longer than the envelope. Ronald cannot see what is written on the check. Nobody can see it. "For mercy's sake, Wesson," cries Grandma impatiently, "get on with what you're going to say." Grandpa cannot hear her. He examines the check another long, serious moment, then casts a sudden, mischievous glance at the assemblage. "My income tax for this year is 13 cents, says Grandpa. The table dissolves in laughter, with Grandpa laughing the hardest of all. When order is restored and the dishes begin to move, Grandpa looks around merrily. "I am happy to do my share," he says. Well, what I hope that you're writing for today will be your own stories. You don't have to wait till you're my age to write down the good stories of your own childhood. And as for your parents and your grandparents, why don't you ask them tonight?
WSSR Radio has presented Reading and Writing and Radio. Send your writings to Jacqueline Jackson, Sangamon State University, Springfield, Illinois, 62708.